All right, we're on, like I said, page 14, and last time we talked about the stages of which God leaves the temple. But remember, in around Jerusalem, and the temple sits up here. And what we're going to be trying to depict here this evening is the departure of the glory cloud. Maybe we should use it. Well, from this point right here, right from the Holy of Holies, and we're going to see this gradual departure to the east. And maybe we should say it this way. It is maybe not so much surprising. It's disappointing in the fact that Israel should know better, but so should we with our sin. Yet, at the same time, we get the impression from this that it is certainly done reluctantly. Right? God gradually departs. He doesn't simply say, well, that's it, I'm done, right? And stomp off, right? It's a gradual departure for a variety of reasons, I think. Another thing we need to remember is that the glory cloud apparently is not something that simply envelops the entire temple, right? Because you can tell that it goes from point A to point B to point C, right? So it's small enough to be able to discern distinctions in locations, right? So let's, if we can, look at chapter 8, see how far we get here, verses at least 1 through 13 here on this first page, and then I'll hand out the other set of notes. So the vision that is communicated here describes the idolatry in the temple. These are shocking in many ways. We sometimes think, oh, Israel's idolatry took place, you know, out in the hills, out in the woods. No, it took place right in the temple itself. Okay? So that's like, if you will, and again, this is minimal in comparison, but it is still a horrific thing. It is as though one spouse is committing adultery with their sinning partner within the marital home. Okay, you can think of it that way. Okay, so it's not just meeting in a hotel. It's not just meeting somewhere else. It's committing sexual immorality, adultery in your own home, in your own bedroom, right? Think of it that way, okay? Now, what God experiences, I shouldn't say it that way, what God communicates here in chapter 8 is infinitely beyond an offended spouse. And being the offended spouse is horrible, right? If you've talked to and counseled with couples and adultery has been a cause of their division, and yet the sin against God is infinitely worse. Okay? Not to minimize the adultery, anything like that, but put it in perspective. So you can see here in September of 592 BC, happened in the sixth year on the fifth day of the sixth month, that I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, that the hand of Adonai Yahweh fell on me there. Now again, obviously an expression, a figure of speech, right? It is not as though God's literal hand, right, landed in his lap, right? It's God's hand is upon him. God is working in Ezekiel's life. And I looked, and behold, a likeness as the appearance of one on fire from his loins, And downward there was the appearance of fire, and from his loins, and upward was the appearance of brightness like the gleam of glowing metal. He sent forth the form of a hand and took me by the lock of my head. And the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem. I don't know, does that make you a little... God picking him up by the hair of his head, right? Right? By grabbing somebody by their ear and helping them along. Similar thing. Brought me to the entrance of the north gate of the inner court. Now, and again, the temple proper, we have the bigger, not quite rectangular temple proper, and we had the, well, let's make it a solid line. I'm not sure if there was a gate on the west, but the point is, what Ezekiel is describing here, he has been brought here to the north gate on the inner court. Okay, so he's coming into the court of women. Okay, now what that does then is there's going to be nothing. There's nothing else in here, right? The next thing is the holy place and the Holy of Holies. Okay? So, and the whole point of this is remembering for the average Jew, they have never been, you know, they're never going to be in here, right? Can't go in there. So this is God's house, right? This is God's home. This is where Deuteronomy describes God having revealed that he would cause his name to dwell. Of all the places on planet Earth, God chose this spot in this city, right? Now, what do people do in God's house? They have come, so to speak, into God's home, and look what it says. Where the seat of the figure of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy, was located. In other words, it's an idol that was established to cause jealousy. Okay? So they knew what they were doing, right? One does not set up an idol in this location by accident. Okay? Understand what Ezekiel is saying here. It's not this is not Aaron, right, throwing the gold into the fire and the idol made itself. It happened. No, this idol did not grow here, right? This is not a wild idol. This is one that they built on purpose right here to provoke Yahweh to jealousy. You get the idea of the heart attitude here? This is brazen. This is in your face. Now look at verse 4. Do you see the mercy of God here? And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there. Why? Right? Because he promised he would be there. Like the appearance which I saw in the plain. Now, this vision that Ezekiel sees is very similar to what he had observed in chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. We've talked about this inner court of the temple. I've underscored some of the references there that I thought might be a little more pertinent to this. But the point is, point number 3 on your outline under letter A, God's Shekinah glory. Now again, the term Shekinah glory means the Shekan to dwell or to be near. God's glory was ignored while the people worshipped the idol in God's residence. So that would be akin to the wife having her boyfriend come into the living room while her husband is watching television, and she sits on the couch and commits adultery with her boyfriend. Okay. Does that make sense? Not to be rude, but you understand the significance of this. Yahweh is alienated from his people in his own house. And one other staggering thought. And I know this is not in Scripture, but we know from, or it's not stated here in Ezekiel, but we know from other parts of Scripture. Understanding this, at night is what? The glory cloud is illuminated, right? At night. Which means what? You can come to worship your false god in God's house by the light of God's glory. Isn't that mind-blowing, right? How ungrateful, how brazen, how audacious this is. Worshiping the false god by the light of God's glory. Now, Ezekiel gives to us then in verses 5 and 6, and I hope you get just a glimpse of how shocking this is, right? Understanding what Ezekiel has just described. Now he's there, right, in a supernatural transportation in this vision, but nonetheless, it still obviously makes an impact. And God communicates to Ezekiel and says, there are three primary reasons why my glory is going to leave the temple. Now, does God have to give him any reasons? No. But he chooses to, and this first reason is because of idolatry. Chapter 8 and verse 5, then he said to me, Son of man, raise your eyes now toward the north. And so I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, to the north of the altar gate was this figure of jealousy at the entrance. And he said to me, Son of man, are you seeing what they're doing, the great abominations which the house of Israel is doing, so that I would be far from my sanctuary? Right? So that's the reason why I'm leaving, because of these abominations, these things that are disgusting to me. But God says what? But wait, it gets worse, right? Is what he says. But yet you will see still greater abominations, which is hard to imagine. But so we have this altar gate near the altar of sacrifice. It is the gate, ironically, that is the closest to the king's private residence, from what I've been able to ascertain. Daniel Block says it this way, and you've heard something similar to this probably before. What God is saying is this: either Yahweh alone is Israel's God, or he is not their God at all. Right? And Jesus teaches that throughout the Gospels, right? And clearest when he says, no one can serve two masters. You are not able to be the slave of two masters. So the second reason in chapter 8, verses 7 through 13, is that of animal worship. And I would hope, and you're thinking that Romans 1 pops in mind, right? Of the sinfulness that is described there in Romans 1, verses 21 through 23. But in verses 7 through 10, the creatures that are being worshipped, he brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, behold, a hole in the wall. And he said to me, Son of man, now dig through the wall. So I dug through the wall, and behold, an entrance. And he said to me, go in and see the evil abominations that they are doing here. And that's a tough command to obey for a priest, a believing priest. And so I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved on the wall all around. Okay, so they have taken God's house, not only moved idols into it, but have graffitied or carved into the stone walls of the temple. Okay? They have defaced God's building with idols. Verse 11. Standing in front of them were 70 elders of the house of Israel, with Jaazaniah and the son of Shaphan standing among them, each man with his censer in his hand and the fragrance of the cloud of incense rising. And he said to me, Son of man, do you see what the elders in the house of Israel are doing in the dark, each man in the room of his carved images? For they say, Yahweh does not see us. Now, just stop right there. They're in God's house. And why do they say God does not see us? Because Yahweh has forsaken the land. Has Yahweh forsaken the land? No. Not yet. Not ever, right? Because that land belongs to Israel. God has promised to that to them. And he will not forsake that land. So they have, you understand their theology, right? God is ignorant. And number two, God is not trustworthy. He has broken his promises. Right? That's the way they're thinking. Now, they are worshiping, and they are worshiping in Yahweh's temple, but they are not worshiping Yahweh. Now, this Shaphan that is referenced here, their house was generally faithful to Yahweh, and we have an exception to that rule here, and I've given you some other references there, but the point is, here are 70 leaders of the house of Israel. This is not just the rabble from throughout the nation, but rather these are leaders who should know better, right? Leaders who should, I'll let you sort those. Leaders who ought to know better in their, and set the example of, So they, again, not accidental in what they're doing, deliberate in what they're doing, flagrantly doing this in the house of God. Now, they assume on the top of page 15 that God does not see them. So they deny, and I've given you several things about their theology. They've denied his immutability. In other words, they say God has changed. Right? Being immutable means he does not change. So they are saying that God is not. See, that's a double negative. If he is not immutable. So they are saying God is mutable. God can change. They are saying God does not see. He is not here. He's abandoned his land. So they're denying his omnipresence. They're denying his omniscience. They're denying his faithfulness. These are the guys who are supposed to be the leaders in the whole country. Their theology is so bad. Daniel Block, in his commentary, says this, in letter B there in your outline, what the men in this dark room are saying about Yahweh is in fact false about him, but it is true of the images before which they stand. So in other words, what? They're taking the attributes of the idols and attributing them to God, to the one true God. That makes sense? And as the commercial says, but wait, it gets worse. Okay, if that's possible. Verses 14 and 15. And he brought me to the entrance of the gate of the house of Yahweh, which was toward the north. And behold, which again is a Hebrew way of saying, and look, right? It's in always that word behold is always intended to catch your attention. Women were sitting there weeping for Tammuz. So it's not just the men who are sinning. Here the women are engaged as well in worshiping false gods. What is Tammuz? I've typed in some other names that this demon is worshipped by. Dumuzi, or you might know it as the Greeks and Romans refer to Adonis. Okay, so some people will refer sometimes to a young man as having the body of Adonis. Right, that's from here. Okay, it's this worship of it's a fertility cult. Now Tammuz. Was a god who would die. There's slight differences on this depending on who's telling the story, so to speak. But apparently Tammuz would die fall, early winter, and then he would resurrect in the spring. Now, of course, then what do you need to do if you want to worship Tammuz or Adonis, right? You're going to have to imitate what he does, and if he's associated with the fertility rituals and the bringing of your spring crops, well then you're going to have to engage in sexual immorality to help Tammuz or Adonis resurrect back from the dead, right? Because after all, your gods need your help, right? Kind of goofy, but that's their thinking. Ironically, what? They've abandoned the giver of rain so that they would worship a false god with the hopes that rain would come, but God had already promised he would give them the early rains and the latter rains. Okay? So, again, but wait, it gets worse, right? You will see still greater abominations than these, which leads us to the fourth reason here in verses 16 through 18. And he brought me into the inner court of the house of Yahweh, and behold, at the entrance to the temple of Yahweh between the porch and the altar, there were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of Yahweh and their faces toward the east. And they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. So now they have moved from the north, and now they are over here to the east side. Now, again, multiple religions around the globe would worship the sun, right? That's why there are different buildings, different things you can find around the world that on the first day of spring, the openings of certain buildings, certain caves, line up exactly, right? The sun rises and it shines exactly on that spot, right? It's amazing to think about that. But what they've done is what? You understand the picturesque description of their idolatry? They've turned their back. To face the east, you got to turn your back on the one true God. Now, they may not have even thought of that, right? But reality is, in order to face the rising sun, you got to turn your back on the one true God. Literally. And that is what they do here. these men, who are probably priests, have turned their back on Yahweh to face the east, and sun worship in the land of Israel is still attested to in various names in the cities around Israel. You can go to Beth Shemesh, which means the house of the sun. You can go to En Shemesh, which means the spring of the sun, where the water comes that the sun has provided for you. Or Mount Heres, which is another word for the sun as well. Verse 17, and he said to me, do you see this, son of man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to do the abominations which they have done here, that they have filled the land with violence and have provoked me to anger still more? For behold, they are sending forth the twig to their nose, which is a interesting expression that not everybody agrees on the meaning of that or the significance of that, perhaps associated with the worship of Tammuz. Therefore also I will do this in wrath. Now again, listen to what God is saying, and he's saying this about his own people. My eye will have no pity, nor will I spare. Now again, isn't he the God who is a God of compassion? God is saying, I am going to withhold that which flows from the very essence of my character. I'm going to withhold that from you. And one demonstration of that is at the end of verse 18, they will cry in my ears with a loud voice, and yet I will not listen to them. Now, I've typed in there for you point number three, that God hears all prayers, but he chooses not to respond favorably to all prayers. Now, God hears all things. God knows all things. Does God hear the prayer of unsaved people? Yes. Does he respond favorably to the prayers of unsaved people? Generally not, right? Does God hear all of your prayers? Yes. Does he respond favorably to all your prayers? No, he doesn't. He responds wisely. But God hears. But he is telling them, I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to respond favorably, no matter how loud they cry, no matter how loud they yell in their worship, so to speak. Letter F, another quote from Block and his helpful commentary. The biggest threat to Israel is not from the Babylonians who imposed new religions on them. Rather, it grew from within. The hope expressed in the name Ya'azanya, which means Yahweh hears. The hope expressed in his name is in vain. God says, I am not going to respond favorably. Now, these four things, and I've given you there what some people see, these four different types of worship to reflect Canaanite worship, Egyptian worship, Mesopotamian or Babylonian worship, and then just blend it all together in what's called syncretism, right? Work it all together. There may or may not be some significance to those four descriptions there, but the point is, Israel is doing these four things, which is bad enough. Just to do one of them is bad enough. So they're doing all four of these things. But again, that's bad enough, but they're doing all four of these things within the house of God. They're doing these four things in the very temple that God has given to them, which Solomon built, which has been one of the wonders of the ancient world. And God has displayed, has made visible the display of his presence by day and by night. And they are rejecting the God who is there, and they are rejecting the God who hears. They are rejecting the God of grace and the God of mercy, and they are rejecting God the Creator and worshiping the things God created instead of the Creator. Right? So, should it surprise us that God says, "I'm going to leave"? And I would argue that we ought not be surprised. We ought to be not discouraged. At the same time, it should, perhaps the best word is, we should grieve over it. But God cannot stay any longer. And I think we have enough time because chapter 9 is rather short. In 11 verses. So let's go ahead to page 16 if we can. We now are going to see the glory cloud begin to move to the east. So it is going to leave the Holy of Holies, or the holiest place, and it is going to stand in the doorway, right? Which is what the threshold is. And we see that described in chapter 9. First of all, verses 1 and 2, God summons the punishers to come. And he cried out in my hearing with a loud voice. Now, let me just stop right there. Doesn't that sound similar to what just happened in verse 18? The people of Israel cried with a loud voice, and God did not listen to them. And now God cries out with a loud voice, saying, "Draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand." And behold, six men were coming from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen with a scribe's case at his loins or around his waist. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar. So they've been summoned. Perhaps, probably, would probably be the better word, probably six angels who are now in temporary human form, and they have come to destroy. Which tells us then the theology of the people of Israel was wrong, right? God was still there, and God had still seen. Now, you may not like what God is. I wish God would act. Well, he's going to act, right? Yeah, but I don't like that part. Well, again, God is acting because he has seen, and he has heard, which then, in verses 3 through 8, there's a distinguishing between repentant people of Israel and unrepentant people of Israel. And we see in verse 3, "Then the glory of the God of Israel went up from the cherub on which it had been to the threshold of the house of Yahweh." So apparently, now, as I said at the beginning, apparently the glory cloud was such that it was distinct enough that we could that Ezekiel can describe this transition from the holiest of holies out to the doorway. Okay, so there's something clearly defined in this cloud. And it says in verse 4, the end of verse 3, "And he called to the man clothed in linen at whose loin was the scribe's case. And Yahweh said to him," and here's this act of grace, Go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being done in its midst. In other words, what? They grieve over the sin that is taking place in the temple. Now, we don't know exactly how many there are. And apparently, as it was difficult even for the people to distinguish who they were. And so this angel is going to come and identify them. And he says to the other six, he said in my hearing, go through the city after him and strike. Do not let your eye have pity and do not spare. Now again, this gets difficult. Kill to utter destruction old men, chosen men, virgins, little ones, and women, which pretty much encompasses the entire group, right? There aren't too many others that you could include. But do not mark any man, do not touch any man on whom is the mark. And you shall start from my sanctuary. You're going to start with those who are the leaders in, right? It was the 70 elders who were there. And so they started with the elders who were before the house. And he said to them, and again, this is God speaking of his dwelling place. Defile the house. And fill the courts with the slain. Go out. And thus they went out and struck down the people in the city. Now it happened as they were striking the people, I alone remained, that I fell on my face and cried out and said, alas, Adonai Yahweh, the sovereign Yahweh, are you destroying the whole remnant of Israel by pouring out your wrath on Jerusalem? That's what it appears. Verse 9, and he said to me, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah. Now notice how God says this. He doesn't simply say that it is great. He doesn't say that it is very great. He says it is very, very great. You can't get any stronger, right? This is as powerful as God could say this. And the land is filled with bloodshed. And the city is full of perversion. Now again, look at what they say. And again, this is their theology. Yahweh has forsaken the land, and Yahweh does not see. So what have the people learned from the elders? Bad theology, right? But as for me, verse 10, my eye will have no pity, nor will I spare, but I will put their way upon their heads. In other words, what? They're going to experience what they've earned. Somebody says to God, leave me alone. Okay. He may do that. Now the repentant have been marked. The unrepentant are punished. The temple is profaned. But Yahweh explains his punishment by saying justice requires judgment. And the fact that God sends this seventh angel to mark the remnant tells us that God does see. And God does know, right? Now they may not like that, but God does see. And God does judge those who are guilty. And God chooses to not show compassion. Now, can we back up? We have time. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. 2 Chronicles chapter 36. And verse 17. There we go. In fact, let's back up to verse 15. 2 Chronicles chapter 36, beginning in verse 15. And Yahweh, the God of their fathers, sent word to them again and again by the hand of the messengers, of his messengers. Why? Because. What? He had compassion on his people. I say, well, over here in Ezekiel says he has none, right? Depending on the context, right? He had compassion on his people and on his habitation, but they continually mocked the messengers of God. They despised his words. They scoffed at his prophets. Until the wrath of Yahweh arose against his people, until there was no remedy. Therefore, he brought up against them the king of the Chaldeans. Now again, the Chaldeans, at one point in history, were distinct from the Babylonians, but they all live kind of in the same neighborhood. Chaldeans are slightly different, who killed their choice men with the sword in the house of their sanctuary and had no compassion on choice man or virgin, old man or infirm. He gave them all into his hand. Now, Ezekiel's describing it to be apparently some form of angelic activity. The writer of Chronicles is saying it was being done by the Chaldeans. Okay? Sometimes it's hard to tell the difference, and it's hard for us unless God explains the difference for us. Verse 18, and all the articles of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of Yahweh, and the treasures of the king and of his officials, he brought them all to Babylon. And they burned down the house of God and tore down the walls of Jerusalem, made it defenseless, and burned all its palaces with fire and destroyed all its valuable articles. And those who had escaped from the sword, he took away into exile to Babylon, and they were slaves to him and to his sons until the rule of the kingdom of Persia. Why? Verse 21. To fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah. Until the land had made up for its Sabbaths. In other words, well, as the rest of the verse says, all the days of its desolation it kept Sabbath until 70 years were fulfilled. So they had to rest every 50 years, right? The year of Jubilee, and they were supposed to rest. Okay? So that is tells you how long they abandoned that activity. So God keeps his promise. God works through indirect means. He worked through these angels. He worked indirectly through the Babylonians or the Chaldeans. So did God punish his people? Yes. Did God do it directly, as though God himself came down and did this? No, he did it indirectly. He did it through angels, and he did it through the Babylonians. The Babylonians treated Jerusalem about as bad as the Romans did, right? In AD 67 through 70. And the destruction of Jerusalem then made it defenseless, tore down its walls so it could not defend itself. And remember, as we went through Ezra and Nehemiah and having to come back and to rebuild all that was destroyed. All part of God's response to these people for their idolatry, for their excessive wickedness, their shamelessness in his temple. Now, let us not forget that the glory cloud has been residing here, right? It has now gone out to the doorway. But what does that mean? As the rest of these things take place, is that the glory cloud, God dwelling there, is watching this destruction. Right? He is present. God sees. So, Simi, this is a... There are certain parts in the whole book of Ezekiel that are just really uncomfortable, as far as I'm concerned. And this is one of them, that God... Not that God responds in this way, but that God tolerates and is so patient in enduring the sin of his people to the point where he at this time says, enough is enough. Right? That's what happens here. Now, God is not responding, and God does not slam on the brakes and throw the car in park and that's not what happens here. This is all God has already revealed that this is going to happen, right? That it might be fulfilled through the mouth, that the word of Yahweh through the mouth of Jeremiah would be fulfilled, right? So God told them again and again. He told them through Moses, and they rejected. So this ought not to come as a surprise to them, and yet when it comes, they say, God doesn't see, God doesn't care, and God has forsaken us. God does not see. He's not paying any attention. But it's not their fault, right? They never say, at least here, they never say, oh, woe is us, for we have sinned. Right? It's God's fault. So I want to stop there, but next time, if we can pick up with chapter 10, we have the third part of the vision, and Yahweh is going to ascend now. The glory cloud is going to ascend into the air up above. And so we, again, apparently it's such that you can see this clear distinction of this. But the burning of Jerusalem comes. And I think there is a... Well, we'll see in chapter 10 this word that is used 22 times in chapter 10, the cherubim. We pronounce it cherubs usually in American English, but cherubim is plural, cherub would be the singular. But 22 times in chapter 10 we see these creatures. And we're also going to see a lot of echoes from chapter 1 in chapter 10. So that's why we spent more time in chapter 1 to get started with this study. So, all right, we've covered a lot here this evening, but as I said, I find it difficult to, difficult to study through in preparation for this, and it's difficult at times to communicate, because this is not what we as pastors are told we should teach to God's people, because nobody wants to listen to this. This is not going to make people want to come to church, but it's in the Word of God, right? And I'm not going to apologize for it, but I find it difficult. We don't rejoice. Again, this is that difficulty for us as believers. We grieve that it has come to this point, but at the same time, we are grateful that our God is holy and just, and he deals with sin as it deserves, right? That's hard. It's difficult. And I would argue it ought to be really difficult for us, right? If we're not moved by this, I would argue there's something wrong. These are difficult visions. And here's Ezekiel not only having to see this in the vision, but he's got to write it all down, right? He's got to communicate this to people and the difficulties that are associated with that. So, all right, any questions or comments, any observations you might have over what we looked at tonight? Go ahead. Yeah.
It's almost in our lives too. He keeps using little bits of pieces there. He digs in us and chisels us. You're going to find out I am.
Yeah.
I'm going to.
Yeah.
So he uses that as an application.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are those that will. What? How is it described? Those who will. Those who. What was it? Moan? I lost my. Those who sigh and groan, right? Those who sigh and groan over the abomination. Those who are grieved at sin, right? There's that. It's not those who celebrate sin. It's not those who tolerate sin. It's those who sigh and groan over the sin. Okay? So it's a good point. God is, this is not just raw justice, right? It has a purpose, that they might know that Yahweh is indeed the one true God. Go ahead.
I think this hit me when we were going through some of the Kings and Chronicles too, but coming from Roman Catholicism, it's like, you know, there you are, supposedly the host is up in the tabernacle, and yet at St. Mary's you've got statues of supposed saints that are all around. So it's like you've got Yahweh and you've got all of the abominations also right there in front of you where people pray to the various saints and stuff like that. It's absolutely nothing different between the Old Testament Israel and Roman Catholicism. You know, I see it all the time in myself.
Yeah. Yeah, and for those of us not raised in that, it's harder, a little harder for us to grasp. But good. All right, anybody else?
I was just thinking along that same theme. There's, you know, they say history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
That's interesting. Yeah. 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 That's a good way to put it. Yeah, the sin, you know, what's that Christmas carol? And with the ever-circling years, we don't sing that song but here at Calvary, but there are those who do, and I don't pick it as a song because of that theology. Now, we're just stuck in a cycle of, you know, well, that might be, is that Buddhism that has that? You just kind of recycle karma and reincarnation until you get it right. Yeah, of course, very few, if any, ever get it right. But that's what reincarnation is, the punishment. It is you recycle. And some people say that history does that same thing. But God is not just stuck in the loop, right? God is not Gene Roddenberry with some weird Star Trek deal where people, they get stuck in some temporal loop and go through the same thing again and again and again. God is moving toward a purpose, which is what you pointed out. His purpose is that they will know that I am Yahweh. Right? Now, there may be similarities, It may rhyme. But, and there are sins that people commit generation after generation after generation. But God is moving toward a purpose and a goal. As horrific as this sin is, but it's time, God says, I've already revealed, it's time for this to come to an end. Right? And it does. So, as painful as it is. And even then, people say, well, oh, it's not fair. Like, well, how many years? Right? If this is, what did I have in our notes, 592 BC, so let's just say 600. So they've been at this for 800 years. Right? 800 years, God has been communicating to them, telling them, there's the way to walk, there's a way not to walk. Obedience brings blessing, disobedience brings curses. 800 years, that's a long sermon, right? And what did they do? What did we read in 2 Chronicles? They scoffed and they mocked and they rejected. And so it's not like, oh, but I didn't have a chance. Yeah, you did. 800 years. Yeah, but we didn't. Yeah, 800 years. Prophet after prophet after prophet after prophet, right? So, yeah, the time has come to deal with the sin as it needs to be dealt with. All right, good.
Well, it's like Nehemiah chapter 9, if you read through it, it says, and they sang, and then we cried out, and then we came, and then we did it over and over and over. Jesus, we're reading it, it's just.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, the book of Judges, right? And God disciplined them, and then they repented, and then they obeyed for a little while, and then they went into idolatry, and God sent them. You know, and we see that similarities, the rhyming, in the book of Judges. But even then, God says it comes to an end. So. All right, well, let's stop there then.